immense popularity. The senator's speech brought anger, confusion, and political reverberations. The Toledo Blade told its readers that, "On this issue, as on so many others, Senator Taft shows that he has a wonderful mind which knows practically everything and understands practically nothing." The Cleveland Plain Dealer editorialized that Taft may be technically correct, but turning loose on the world the worst gang of cutthroats in all history would have failed to give the world that great principle which humanity needs so desperately to have established. The principle that planning and waging aggressive war is definitely a crime against humanity. Senator Taft was disheartened by the veracity of his critics, and extremely uncomfortable when one of the acquitted Nazi leaders, Franz von Papen, told interviewers upon his release from prison that he agreed with Taft's speech. A spokesman for Taft issued only one terse statement. He has stated his feelings on the matter and feels that if others want to criticize him, let them go ahead. But the Ohio senator could not understand why even his old supporter, newspaper columnist David Lawrence, called his position nothing more than a technical quibble. And he must have been particularly distressed when respected constitutional authorities, such as the president of the American Bar Association, the chairman of its executive committee, and other leading members of the legal profession, all deplored his statement and defended the trials as being in accordance with international law. For Robert A. Taft had spoken not in defense of the Nazi murderers, as a labor leader had charged, not in defense of isolationism, as most observers assumed, but in defense of what he regarded to be the traditional American concepts of law and justice. As the apostle of strict constitutionalism, as the chief defense attorney for the conservative way of life and government, Robert Alfonso Taft was undeterred by the possibility of injury to his party's precarious position or his own presidential prospects. To him, justice was at stake, and all other concerns were trivial. "It illustrates at once," a columnist observed at the time, "the extreme stubbornness, integrity, and political strong-headedness of Senator Taft." The storm raised by his speech eventually died down. The Nazi leaders were hanged, and Taft and the country went on to other matters. But we are not concerned today with the question of whether Taft was right or wrong in his condemnation of the Nuremberg trials. What is noteworthy is the illustration furnished by this speech of Taft's unhesitating courage in standing against the flow of public opinion for a cause he believed to be right. His action was characteristic of the man who authored this lasting definition of liberty. "When I say liberty, I mean liberty of the individual to think his own thoughts and live his own life as he desires to think and live." The meaning of courage. These have been stories about courage in politics. Politics furnished the situations, courage provided the theme. Some demonstrated courage through their unyielding devotion to absolute principle. Others demonstrated courage through their acceptance of compromise, through their advocacy of conciliation, through their willingness to replace conflict with cooperation. Surely their courage was of equal quality, though of different caliber. For the American system of government could not function if every man in a position of responsibility approached each problem as John Quincy Adams did, as a problem in higher mathematics, but with a limited regard for sectional needs and human shortcomings. Most of them, despite their differences, held much in common. The breathtaking talents of the orator, the brilliance of the scholar, the breadth of the man above party and section, and, above all, a deep-seated belief in themselves, their integrity, and the rightness of their cause. The meaning of courage, like political motivations, is frequently misunderstood. Some enjoy the excitement of its battles, but fail to note the implications of its consequences. Some admire its virtues in other men and other times, but fail to comprehend its current potentialities. Perhaps, to make clear the significance of these stories of political courage, it would be well to say what these stories are not. They are not intended to justify independence for the sake of independence, obstinacy to all compromise, or excessively proud and stubborn adherence to one's own personal convictions. Nor are they intended to suggest that there is on every issue, one right side and one wrong side, and that all senators, except those who are knaves or fools, will find the right side and stick to it. Finally, they are not intended to disparage democratic government and popular rule. The examples of constituent passions unfairly condemning a man of principle are not unanswerable arguments against permitting the widest participation in the electoral process. The stories of men who accomplished good in the face of cruel calumnies from the public are not final proof that we should at all times ignore the feelings of the voters on national issues. For, as Winston Churchill has said, democracy is the worst form of government, except all those other forms that have been tried from time to time. We can improve our democratic processes, we can enlighten our understanding of its problems, and we can increase our respect for those men of integrity who find it necessary, from time to time, to act contrary to public opinion. But we cannot solve the problems of legislative independence and responsibility by abolishing or curtailing democracy. For democracy means much more than popular government and majority rule, much more than a system of political techniques to flatter or deceive powerful blocks of voters. A democracy that has no George Norris to point to, no monument of individual conscience in a sea of popular rule, is not worthy to bear the name. The true democracy, living and growing and inspiring, puts its faith in the people, faith that the people will not simply elect men who will represent their views ably and faithfully, but also elect men who will exercise their conscientious judgment, faith that the people will not condemn those whose devotion to principle leads them to unpopular courses, but will reward courage, respect honor, and ultimately recognize right. These stories are the stories of such a democracy. Indeed, there would be no such stories had this nation not maintained its heritage of free speech and dissent, had it not fostered honest conflicts of opinion, had it not encouraged tolerance for unpopular views. Cynics may point to our inability to provide a happy ending for each chapter, but I am certain that these stories will not be looked upon as warnings to beware of being courageous. For the continued political success of many of those who withstood the pressures of public opinion and the ultimate vindication of the rest enables us to maintain our faith in the long-run judgment of the people. And thus neither the demonstrations of past courage nor the need for future courage are confined to the Senate alone. Not only do the problems of courage and conscience concern every office holder in our land, however humble or mighty, and to whomever he may be responsible, voters, a legislature, a political machine, or a party organization, they concern as well every voter in our land, and they concern those who do not vote, those who take no interest in government, those who have only disdain for the politician and his profession. They concern everyone who has ever complained about corruption in high places, and everyone who has ever insisted that his representative abide by his wishes. For in a democracy, every citizen, regardless of his interest in politics, holds office. Every one of us is in a position of responsibility. And in the final analysis, the kind of government we get depends upon how we fulfill those responsibilities. We, the people, are the boss, and we will get the kind of political leadership, be it good or bad, that we demand and deserve. These problems do not even concern politics alone, for the same basic choice of courage or compliance continually faces us all, whether we fear the anger of constituents, friends, a board of directors, or our union, whenever we stand against the flow of opinion on strongly contested issues. For without belittling the courage with which men have died, we should not forget those acts of courage with which men have lived. The courage of life is often a less dramatic spectacle than the courage of a final moment, but it is no less a magnificent mixture of triumph and tragedy. A man does what he must in spite of personal consequences, in spite of obstacles and dangers and pressures, and that is the basis of all human morality. To be courageous, these stories make clear, requires no exceptional qualifications, no magic formula, no special combination of time, place, and circumstance. It is an opportunity that sooner or later is presented to us all. Politics merely furnishes one arena which imposes special tests of courage. In whatever arena of life one may meet the challenge of courage, whatever may be the sacrifices he faces if he follows his conscience, the loss of friends, his fortune, his contentment, even the esteem of his fellow men, each man must decide for himself the course he will follow. The stories of past courage can define that ingredient. They can teach. They can offer hope. They can provide inspiration. But they cannot supply courage itself. For this, each man must look into his own soul.
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Cadman. To receive a complete catalog of Cadman and Harper Audio titles, try our website, harperaudio.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.